Today is Wednesday, November 1st. We're going to be working on Chapter 13, Spinal Cord and Spinal Nerve Information today. So we're going to start off by talking about the spinal cord and spinal nerves first, and then we'll talk about the brain and cranial nerves next. After we lay the foundation for the structure and functions of the central and peripheral nervous systems, then we'll branch off and talk about autonomic and, you know, somatic, and go into a little more detail. So let's start by talking about the types of protection for our central nervous system. Our central nervous system is two organs, brain and spinal cord. We do have bony protection for those organs. We have the skull that protects the brain, and we have the vertebrae that form a protective device around the spinal cord. So let's focus on the spinal cord for a few minutes. The spinal cord is going to run from the base of your brain, it exits from your foramen magnum, and it travels down your spine, of course, and it terminates around your waistband. So your spinal cord does not travel all the way to the very end of your vertebral column. It's going to terminate around vertebrae L1 or L2. What does that L tell us?
Lumbar,
good. So for us, lumbar vertebrae is about where your spine makes a curvature, and not to be crude here, but it's where your butt starts. So, you know, if you're thinking about your waistband and then where your butt emerges, that is around where L1 or L2 is going to sit. And to be really crude, it's where your crack starts. Okay? So that's about the point at which you no longer have a spinal cord. Now, interesting to make this point, because if you have a spinal cord injury, you can only injure down to that point. Beyond L1 or L2, there's only spinal nerves that emerge. And you can see them coming off here. They branch off into this, what looks to be a horse's tail pattern. And for that reason, they call it the cauda equina. Literally translated, it is the horse's tail. Okay? And so that's near the top of your page there on, 104. Right before we emerge with the cauda equina, we have a tapered cone-shaped ending. It's called the conus medullaris. So conus medullaris is basically a fancy word that means medial cone, and it's where the spinal cord tapers off around L1 or L2, and then those spinal nerves branch off, which looks like a horse's tail. That's that cauda equina portion at the very end of the spinal cord. Continue the conversation about protective coverings for the spinal cord. We've already talked about the brain having a bony protection from the skull. Spinal cord has a bony protection from the vertebrae. But we also have a type of meninge, which is a membrane covering the outside of both brain and spinal cord. So if you've got these two items at home in your drawer, I think it'll help you understand what we're talking about. Do you have wax paper and saran wrap at home? Okay, so which one is tougher?
The wax paper.
The wax paper. And how would you describe saran wrap?
It's thin.
Thin. Okay.
See-through.
Yeah. Okay. So if I gave you a brain to wrap, the first thing I'd ask you to do is wrap your brain in some saran wrap. And that is actually a type of membrane that we call a pia mater. And if I then said, okay, now that you've wrapped your brain in saran wrap, let's wrap it in wax paper. The wax paper is actually a thicker, a tougher type of wrapping, and that's an outermost covering that we call a dura mater. Dura mater means tough mother. It is, in fact, the outermost covering of the brain. It is tough like wax paper, and it anchors the brain not only to the skull, but also has a spider web-like connection that anchors the dura mater to the underlying saran wrap, which is the pia mater. cord is formed the very same way. We wrap the spinal cord with pia mater first. That's the closest membrane covering the spinal cord. And then the dura mater is the outermost layer. And then again, you've got a spider web-like layer called the arachnoid matter that anchors the outer dura mater, which is the tough layer, to the innermost pia mater, which is the soft, delicate layer. Yeah, imagine putting a spider web between your wax paper and your saran wrap. That's the arachnoid matter. All right, so from superficial to deep, the coverings on both brain and spinal cord, dura mater is most superficial. The next layer down is a spider web layer called the arachnoid matter. And beneath the arachnoid matter is a deep layer called the pia matter. DAP, right? Dura, arachnoid, pia.
DAP.
DAP, yeah. Okay. You may notice in these pictures, there doesn't look to be a really juicy blood supply going to these organs. You know, we know our brains will die without oxygen. But the way that oxygen gets there is a little different than it gets to most organs. In fact, your spinal cord needs oxygen, but you don't see a really hearty blood supply going here either. So that cerebrospinal fluid that we're going to do a flow for is what delivers the oxygen to the brain and spinal cord. And that travels in the arachnoid matter that is on the outside surface of the brain and spinal cord. Everybody good? Thanks. Okay, so this is probably about the best picture that you can see the three layers. This spider web layer here, that's that arachnoid matter, and it is the one through which cerebrospinal fluid will circulate. And if we want to sample cerebrospinal fluid, that's where we take it from. We don't bother the organ, we just take it out of the surrounding outside portion. So if you happen to be losing cerebrospinal fluid, maybe because of a leak or a tear in the dura mater, people get horrendously awful headaches, and their brains are supposed to somewhat float in that cerebrospinal fluid, and your brain will actually drop a bit in your skull and head down toward that foramen magnum. So we really want to have adequate cerebrospinal fluid to keep the brain afloat, moisturized, and all the nutrients that we're delivering.
So your brain is like submerged?
Yeah. It's kind of Frankenstein-like. It's floating in a bowl of water, so to speak. It's like Pedialyte. Yeah. So lumbar taps are one way to sample that cerebrospinal fluid and the arachnoid matter. Of course, that's a very delicate procedure because you don't want to puncture the spinal cord. You want to simply go only as far as that arachnoid layer and extract out the cerebrospinal fluid. And likewise, the same type of technique is used to do an epidural. Instead of pulling out fluid, we can put in fluid. So that medication can block motor control. So interesting concept there, not tapping into the organ, but tapping into that epidural space. Okay, let's see. Next on your worksheet is something called the parts of the spinal cord. There are 31 pairs of the spinal cord listed there. Starting at the top of your spinal cord, right as your brain exits and your spinal cord emerges from your foramen magnum, we start having spinal nerves emerge all the way from there down to the cauda equina. And there's a left and right spinal nerve that emerges, and it wraps you like a bear hug from behind. Left and right, those spinal nerves wrap you from the back to the front, and they meet right along your midline at the front. Kind of an interesting concept, because if you have an inflamed nerve, the inflammation may start at your back and work its way toward the front on one side only. It's never going to wrap you all the way around from the back to the median all the way to the other side. That's not the way these nerves are set up. So imagine that they meet along your midline all the way up and down your body. I wanted to tell you a little bit about how these nerves operate. They do exit through the foramen or the intervertebral foramen between the vertebrae. This is digging back in your brain, isn't it? Okay, so there we go, coming out there. And I know that the print here is probably hard to read, but the color coding is what I wanted to pay attention to. There's about four or five sets of spinal nerves emerging from your spinal cord. The set that emerge in your neck area, they're called what?
Cervical.
Good. And then we got thoracic in the chest area. Down below we have lumbar, and then they call these?
Sacral
and coccygeal. Yeah. So those sacral and coccygeal nerves, you'll notice, are in this cauda equina area, as are the lower lumbar spinal nerves as well. So they don't actually, you know, continue branching off the spinal cord because the spinal cord terminates around what vertebrae? Where does the spinal cord stop?
Lumbar.
Yeah, L1 or L2. So pretty much everything from L2 down, there's no more spinal cord. These are just spinal nerves that have branched off like a horse's tail. I just want to take a moment and tell you about the naming scheme here. You know, in lab you probably learned that there are, you know, certain numbers of bones in those vertebral regions. You may have learned that there's 7, 12, and 5, okay? The only difference here is that there are 8 cervical, 12, and 5. Okay, so one minor difference there, okay? 8 cervical, not 7 in terms of spinal nerves. So although there are 7 vertebrae in the cervical region of your neck, there are 8 spinal nerves that emerge around those vertebrae. Okay, so if these are your 7 cervical vertebrae, the way we actually start naming them is a little different. The first set of spinal nerves actually emerge off the top of C1. So we call those that come off the top of C1 our C1 spinal nerves. And the naming scheme goes pretty well until you start getting down here closer to C7. So we know there's 8 cervical spinal nerves. We know there's only 7 cervical vertebrae. So you'll notice that these cervical spinal nerves are actually sitting above the vertebrae that they're named for. So C1 spinal nerves are actually coming off right at the base of your brain, and they're the ones that are going to wrap around close to the top of the spinal cord. Naming scheme follows suit, and then all of a sudden, below C7, you run into spinal nerve pair C8. Well, the next vertebrae sitting below is actually T1, right? Okay, now at this point, we're gonna switch the naming scheme. T1 spinal nerves emerge below T1 vertebra. Okay, so from say C7 up to C1, those spinal nerves are above the vertebra they're named for. Starting with T1 and all the way down, those spinal nerves are sitting below the vertebra they're named for. Okay, so C1 to C7, those spinal nerves are above the vertebrae they're named for. So vertebrae C1 through C7 have their spinal nerves emerge above them. Starting with vertebrae T1 and going on down, those vertebrae have their spinal nerves emerge below. So C1 to C7, the spinal nerve emerges above the vertebrae they're named for. Starting with T1, the spinal nerves emerge below the vertebrae they're named for.
So C8 is just in between C7 and T1?
Yeah. a mess of everything. Does that make sense? So when you look at a picture like this one, you can see the spinal cord is this piece here in the center. And just to review, the spinal cord is part of your central nervous system. Your spinal nerves are part of your peripheral nervous system. These things coming off the sides are actually spinal nerve roots. See how they've kind of split? And then they're together here as a spinal nerve. So I kind of think of it like this. You know, some roads you drive down, they have a median and you're split apart from the other oncoming traffic. And then they get rid of the median and then you're basically, you know, you're going with the oncoming traffic next to you. There's no median dividing. It's not a divided highway. That's kind of what this is. The sensory roots and the motor roots actually divide off from each other. And shortly after the spinal nerve emerges from the spinal cord and passes through the intervertebral foramen, they come together in one big encasement. And now they're considered to be a mixed spinal nerve. And what we mean by mixed is that spinal nerve carries both sensory information and motor information. Okay, so they're considered to be mixed nerves. That means they have both sensory and motor information. So I left you a picture kind of like this one on the bottom of page 105. It's already labeled for you. Or what you can do is if you've got a clean sheet of paper that you want to draw on, I'll draw this with you together. You want to make a drawing with me, just turn it where it's, you know, like landscape and leave enough room to put some spinal nerves on the outside. So I feel like this is art class in first grade, right? In the very center, I would draw something that looks kind of like this H-shaped portion of your spinal cord. That is the gray matter of your spinal cord. Now let's add the white matter around. Spinal cord is special. It has not one crack, but two. So you'll notice there are fissures there. There's one on the back side, one on the front side. And this part that we've now drawn with the two cracks is the white matter of the spinal cord. Now, what you've drawn so far is simply the central nervous system. This is the spinal cord. So I'll just bracket this off. So now let's add a spinal nerve, and the first thing we need to do is add the roots, and then we'll make the mixed nerve where the two roots come together and join. And what you're going to notice is on the back side, when we draw that spinal root, there's going to be a bump back there. And that's going to be a landmark for us that we need to pay attention to. If you'd like, you can draw the same thing on the other side, but if you're limited by space on your paper, we're just going to work with this one side. We'll just label it over here. Since we're labeling parts, let's label this spinal nerve as a portion of the PNS. Okay, let me tell you about how to orient this, because, you know, this could be flipped upside down and it would be like, okay, how do I know top from bottom? The landmark that I use to orient myself is this little bump back here. It's called what? Good, dorsal root ganglion. So when I find that little bump on the backside, dorsal also means back, yeah. So it is the posterior or backside of the spinal cord. In other words, this portion that's running along here and is back here is closest to your back. And the bottom portion down here is actually closer toward the insides. So now that I've got that straight, I can orient the rest of my picture. So that's certainly something we want to pay attention to. That little bump right there, you would want to label as our dorsal root ganglion. So now that we know that is the dorsal root ganglion, we can say, okay, this backside here, this dorsal root is bringing information into the spinal cord. So if it's bringing information to your spinal cord, should we call it sensory or motor?
Sensory,
good. So instead of calling it the dorsal root, you can alternately call it the sensory root of the spinal nerve. And that sensory root brings information into your spinal cord. Sensory root is another name for that dorsal root. That ventral root carries information away from your spinal cord, so an alternate name here could be motor. Yeah. So we're looking at information coming away. doing okay so far? Okay. All right, so notice down at the very bottom of your page, the ventral root has two branches. They are a somatic and an autonomic branch. So when we're talking about controlling skeletal muscle activity, which branch are we talking about?
Somatic.
Somatic, yeah. And if we're talking about maybe communicating with smooth muscle in your intestinal tract, now we're talking autonomic. Okay. So motor control that you can consciously control is somatic in nature. Involuntary motor control, things like glands and organs that you can't consciously think about and make them move, that's going to be an autonomic motor pathway. Nonetheless, both of them come out through this ventral root of your spinal nerve, and they carry on nerves to their own destination. So, you know, we'll talk more about those in just a minute. Let me flip you on over to the next page. Head over to the top of 105. On the top of 105, you've got gray matter of the spinal cord. So if you've ever put your hands on a hot toaster oven, a hot stove, a hot grill, you probably realize how quickly your body responds to something that could potentially be very harmful and surely very painful. So the information that you have sensed comes into your spinal cord by way of these spinal nerves, and it's going to take a branch here as you approach the spinal cord in what we call a sensory root or a dorsal root of the spinal nerve. That information is going to head over here, and it's going to head to a portion of your gray matter. Now, you'll notice the gray matter looks kind of like a butterfly or an H, and I'll go ahead and label the parts here. There's a dorsal horn of the gray matter, there's a lateral horn, and a ventral horn. So when we come into the spinal cord, which horn do you think is back here?
Dorsal horn.
Dorsal horn, good. Bump on the side is lateral. The state of Florida on there, you'll notice it. Okay, state of Florida on here is your ventral horn. So you've got Maine, the Carolinas, and Florida on your gray matter. Go back to the example of putting your hand on a hot surface. If you put your hand on a hot surface, the information comes in from the hand that's potentially being burned. That information comes into a sensory root of your spinal nerve, and it comes first to the dorsal horn of your gray matter, and you'll notice that there we house interneurons. What do interneurons do for a living? Communicate information, right? They are middlemen. They talk between incoming sensory and outgoing motor neurons. So those dorsal horns are going to receive the incoming sensory information, and they say, we know what to do with this. This is very painful. Don't bother the brain. Don't tell the brain. You know, just send out a reflex that makes you move your arm away from the source of potential damage. So we've got two options here. We've got the lateral horn and we've got the ventral horn. And if you look at the picture on the bottom of your page, they actually give you little clues. One is labeled as VM, which stands for visceral motor. Visceral sounds like organs, right? Okay, that is the autonomic branch or the involuntary motor control branch. The bottom one there says SM. That stands for somatic motor. Now, somatic motor is, of course, the control over voluntary skeletal muscles. So if you've got your hand on a hot stove, and you want your skeletal muscles to flex your arm away from the hot pain, which branch are you going to use? Somatic. Yep, tell that somatic motor control to move that arm away. So we're going to skip over the lateral horn with our information, and we're going to come back to that ventral horn and back out the spinal nerve. The spinal nerve carries the motor information out to that muscle group, and then you flex your arm away from the source of pain. So let's label your ventral horn as home to somatic or voluntary motor control. And let's label your lateral horn as autonomic motor. Okay, so let's label your ventral horn as somatic motor. And you may want to add a note there. That's control of what kind of muscles?
Skeletal,
good. And then label your lateral horn there as an autonomic motor control area. And that controls what kind of muscles? Involuntary, that's cardiac, that's smooth. Okay.
Dorsal would also be in the automatic.
It's actually in both, yeah, because it's communicating between incoming sensory, and it can send it to both of these. Yeah, it's wired into both horns, you might say.
So, like you said, it's like a middleman between the two.
It is a middleman, yeah. In a way, it's kind of like the decision maker of the spinal cord. Yeah. So to kind of take this full circle, when you put your hands on a hot stove, there are sensory receptors in your hand that carry information up your arm all the way to your spinal cord. And when that sensory information travels in through a sensory or a dorsal route, it arrives first inside the spinal cord at a dorsal horn, and that's in the gray matter. That dorsal horn is going to be programmed to make a response. And the response that it says is, you know, you need to flex your muscles, flex biceps, brachii, and move your hand away from the source of pain. And so the interneuron tells the ventral horn to send a message out to the skeletal muscles. Now the message travels out the motor root of the spinal nerve, and it continues on by traveling back down through the same spinal nerve, but in a different pafway this time. It's in an efferent or motor pathway, and tells those muscles to contract and get you to move. It's split fast, right? You know, if you pull your hand away from something hot, it's immediate. And eventually your brain's going to know, but it doesn't have to be involved in this response.
That's why after you do a reaction, like your brain's like, what just happened?
Yeah. And you go, oh, that's going to hurt, and then it hits. Yeah. So far, so good. Okay, so, you know, I told you the joke here is don't tell the brain. You know, we're going to handle this on our own. But, you know, in reality, your spinal cord can handle a lot of things on its own. There's a lot of reflexes like this built into your spinal cord. But eventually, if it's important, your brain's gonna hear about it. This piece in the middle is a bridge, and that piece is called the gray commissure. Okay, that piece in the middle there is called the gray commissure, or commissure. Right in here. So let's say we would circle that area there. Okay, so if you've ever stubbed your toe, hurt yourself, or whatever, you probably pulled your arm or your leg back, and then you had this momentary thought of, oh man, that's gonna hurt. And then about a second later, you feel the pain. But you know it's coming, right? Because, you know, the delay is there. So here's why there is a delay. When you've, say, stubbed your toe, put your hand on a hot stove, the spinal cord tells you to move away from the source of pain. But, you know, your brain is going to be aware of what you did. You're cognizant that your foot just hit something or that you put your hand on a hot stove. That sensory information is going to travel across the gray commissure, and it's going to travel an elevator in the white matter up to the brain. So let's take this information all the way across that gray commissure, and let's exit the gray matter. Let's come out here to the white matter. And we're going to hit a set of tracks that carries information up to the brain for processing. So you'll notice that the next thing on our worksheet are ascending tracks for the white matter and descending tracks for the white matter. Ascending tracks are going to be in the lateral columns of the white matter. And so let's label this portion of your spinal cord as lateral columns. Your picture getting kind of full, I bet, isn't it? If you'd like to do this again, I'll bring you a big sheet of paper on, how about Monday, and we'll do it another time just to have the practice. You're going to have the same exact model in lab, so it's worth knowing for both lecture and for lab. While we're labeling, let's go ahead and label our ventral columns and our dorsal columns. So the set that's down here in the white matter, what would you label that as? I put that as ventral. Okay, so the part down here, underneath this like peninsula of the gray matter, down here is going to be your ventral columns of white matter. And then back here, this area up here, that's going to be what kind of column?
Dorsal.
Dorsal columns, good. Stub your toe, you put your hand on a hot stove, something that's painful, okay? Not fun to think about painful stuff, but this is one example of how your spinal cord is going to work. That sensory information comes in by way of your spinal nerve. It branches and travels the dorsal root, which carries sensory information, and it arrives at your dorsal horn. Your dorsal horn says, hey, that hurt. So get this ventral horn to send out a motor response to your skeletal muscles, right back out this motor route, and right back out to wherever you need to move away from that source of pain. Now, while we're taking care of moving away from the source of pain, these dorsal horn interneurons also send a message across the gray commissure. That message skips out of the gray matter and hits over here in either the lateral columns or these ventral columns. There are sets of ascending tracks that carry information up to your brain. Now, going back to what we've learned before, what do you know about white matter and speed versus gray matter and speed? Who's faster?
White matter.
So if you need to travel with information up to your brain, then those ascending tracks are gonna have to hit the fast circuit. They're like speed elevators. They take sensory information up to your brain for processing, okay? And so once in your brain can be conscious and aware of the pain that you're feeling from whatever you've done. Okay, so let me show you two types of ascending tracks. And I'll leave this up here and pull the screen down for you.
I
actually know a lot about this picture already. Let's go back to putting your hand on a hot stove, stubbing your toe, whichever one. You'll notice we're coming in the dorsal root. We hit the interneuron. There we are traveling across the gray commissure. We hop out of the gray matter, and now we're over here in the lateral column, and we're in white matter, and we hit an elevator ride with sensory information all the way up here to the brain. And once we're in the brain, we arrive first at a portion that's called the thalamus. It's kind of like a relay station. It says, hey, you sent me this information goes to the occipital lobe. Oh, you sent me this information, this goes to the frontal lobe. So it decides where that information should be sent inside the brain.
It's kind of like a gateway to the brain.
It is a gateway. That's a great way to think of it. Good. So it sorts this information, and if you send it pain or temperature information, like putting your hand on a hot stove, we're going to hit the thalamus, and then we're going to take it to the right portion of your brain. I do want to mention a term here called contralateral control. You'll notice that if you stubbed or hit something on the right side of your body, it actually travels up the opposite side of your spinal cord, and you'll notice that it's interpreted by the opposite side of your brain. So what you feel on your right hand is actually left side of the brain. Good, good. So that fanciness is called contralateral control. It means opposite control there, so right side is controlled by left hemisphere and vice versa. I kind of think of it as a self-preservation mechanism. Pain and temperature travels this way. You'll notice that if you've got skeletal muscle input or information, it actually travels a different pathway. So another set of ascending tracts are called the spinocerebellar pathway, and they travel to the cerebellum at the back of your brain. So again, we travel up through the ascending tracts, and here the cerebellum can coordinate the muscle movements. So if you happen to be, you know, half asleep and you're stumbling around, people who are medicated or drunk, those proprioceptors can't get the information properly to your spinal cord, and your spinal cord may not properly get information to your brain, and so the coordination of muscle control is just not there. So cerebellum at the back of your brain receives and coordinates information about motor control. What does the thalamus do? Pain and temperature, right? Like a relay station, or like gateway, that's a good way to put it. Last thoughts for today. There are descending tracts that carry motor information down the spinal cord. We'll come back and review that a little bit. But I wanted to leave you with this thought about phantom limb pain. People who have a leg amputated, arm amputated, some body part amputated may experience pain in that portion of their body. It's not that they're actually having true, honest pain from that missing limb. The problem is, in the spinal cord, those nerves are initiating responses that go up the spinal cord into the brain. In this picture here, you may note, well, let me go back one. You may notice that there's a map for your body in the brain. And so even if you're missing a body part, your brain is mapped to experience sensations from that body part. So you have to retrain the brain that the body part's no longer there. And thanks, but no thanks, but we don't need to know about the itching leg that's no longer attached. So low-tech but fairly effective mechanism for treatment is this mirror method. They can sit a patient in front of a mirror, hide the limb that's present, and have the person use that mirror to accept the fact, the brain has to accept the fact, that that missing leg is no longer there and we don't need information about it. So it's a fairly successful, it's a no medication way to treat people who have amputations.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So basically, if it looks at the mirror and sees the limb ain't there, people start to realize that it's gone.
Mm-hmm. And they're not fully understanding how it works, but if it works and it solves phantom limb pain, then great. Yeah. And then referred pain, one last thing here. There are crisscrosses in these wires that travel up your spinal cord and through your to your brain. And sometimes the message gets mixed. So you sometimes feel pain from an area where the pain actually isn't coming from. For instance,
gallbladder in your shoulder.
Gallbladder in your shoulder, yeah. A lot of people feel it right shoulder blade. It's crisscrossing of wires. Heart attack pain, we think of left arm pain, right? Pain should be here in the chest, yeah. So we'll come back and we'll review this page. It's a pretty hefty page of info on Monday. And I'll bring you a big picture of the label too. Good luck on your lab test.